I wanted to point out is that, and we may get some pushback on this also, is that the United States is becoming a very fascist country where the police, the military, are not there to serve and protect the people, but to serve and protect corporations and corporate interests. What do you think?
Well, I'm not going to argue with you on that last one.
Pretty hard to argue with.
Pretty hard to argue it. But I think one of the things we need to explore, and this is difficult, particularly to do in the context of this show and this station, we need to understand how people of goodwill and good intention become police officers.
I agree with you 100%. Those police officers are working inside a system that is already corrupt, and if they want to continue to work there and maybe not become injured by it, they have to sort of go with the flow. But it actually that goes to another point, and that is the application of justice here in this country. Mm-hmm. We have lots of laws. We don't need to change laws. We don't need to add laws. What we need to do is enforce laws to everyone, no matter how rich you are, no matter what position you are. And I think it needs to start at the top. And that includes when we have presidents or whoever that are breaking the laws, that are torturing people, that are invading countries.
Agreed.
Doing all of these things. When you say, no, these people are above the law, then it just kind of trickles down and says, you know what, we can pick and choose who we apply the laws to. And one other thing is what the blacks do for this is, if you can exploit the blacks and punish them and abuse them, white people will look at that and say, I better keep my head down. Right now I'm protected because of the color of my skin. But if I get out of line, somebody's going to shoot me and they don't have to apply the laws. Hmm. Anyway, thanks so much for taking my call, guys.
Thank you. You bet.
I hadn't really considered that last point. The oppression of people of color, does that have a chilling effect on the progressive tendencies of some white folks?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
I don't either.
I think it's an interesting point,
though. It is.
I want to say, I just want to tell a very fast story here.
Okay.
For a long, long time, I taught at a community college, Clackamas Community College, which is in Clackamas County. Clackamas County is a quite conservative area. I was teaching sociology at that time, along with American history. And we had a police program, police training program, mm-hmm. run by a guy named Brulette, who was, for some reason, his name was pronounced Brulette. I don't know why. He used to be a major command officer in Portland. He's gone now. And he was the guy who organized the top, then called Top Squad, which was a tactical smash your head squad. Mm-hmm. And he was the guy who famously did the violent beating but no arresting at the end of the student strike in 1970 at Portland State. He really believed in the use of force, and he really believed that there was a vast left-wing conspiracy that needed to be crushed in this country, and he had no great sympathy for persons of color. He ran the when he retired, he ran the police training program at Clackamas Community College, and part of that program was a sociology course. It took me a long time to discover that he had arranged for somebody within the police community to teach that sociology course so that they, the police officers, would not, the potential police officers, would not be exposed to me and my thinking.
Nice.
And
I said,
well, wait a minute, I'm the sociology guy, you know, a very small school, I'm the sociology guy. Didn't make any difference. He had his own little self-contained unit in which everything was filtered through a mindset of his and of essentially the official police line of that time. It's a long time ago, but it was still real. It was hurtful, but that's not the important point. The important point is that he did not want the officers to be exposed to a variety of opinions. He wanted a certain kind of cultural values and a certain kind of political values and a certain kind of moral values, if you will, to be inculcated in the police officers. And I suspect that's still true in many places, in many ways, so that the officer doesn't stand a chance. Whoever she or he is, they are going to be trained to have a certain perception. Now, the perception does not have to be overtly racist for it to be effectively racist. And I think that's really important to understand. I think we should go some more calls unless you wanted to say something.
Yeah, let's go to the phones. We're also taking your comments on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/Abe and Joe. Let's go to the phones. Jim, good morning.
Hi, yes. I appreciate the topic. I think that if even all of the black societies had completely black police forces helping them, it wouldn't solve the problem totally.
Which black societies do you mean?
No, just the ones that we have in America.
Well,
you know.
Well, I'd say they're part of American society.
Yeah,
everybody here
right.
is part of American society.
Yeah,
well, go ahead.
All right.
What I would like to do, I would like you guys to, we all know that there's a problem, so could you spend most of the time for the rest of the program talking about what you would really do if you had the total power to change.
You mean if we ran the zoo, how we'd organize it?
Yeah. And talk about the future rather than the past and the present, because then we can dig into it and discuss it, really what should be done. But begin with what you guys really could do if you had the power and the money to do it. What's the answer that you guys can give? I'll hang up.
Well, wait a minute. What's the question that we're answering? Because I'm not clear what you want to...
The question is, we all know a problem exists. What would you two men do to change that and make it, to improve it to 100% perfection in America concerning the police force, if you could?
Oh, okay. I can take a stab at that.
That's what I'd like you to do.
Okay. All right. Hey, thanks for the call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
First, I would take guns away from the police.
What?
Yeah. Secondly, I would do something about the way... The whole grand jury system works. There's a built-in conflict of interest for a district attorney. A district attorney who brings charges against a police officer is going in the future to have to work with that very same police department, is have to depend on the testimony of detectives and officers from that same police department. There is a built-in incentive not to prosecute in these cases because DAs and police officers are on the same team. So I think a fundamental revision of how that system works would be helpful. If we could make that system more fair and more objective and less fraught with incentives leaning in the wrong direction. I would also, anytime that an officer of the law perpetrates violence upon a citizen, I think that is basis for a trial. I think the fact that a cop can shoot somebody and then a grand jury can say, well, there's nothing here that suggests there actually needs to be a trial of any kind. I think that if people are going to believe in the justice system, then we need to have the justice system do its thing. If a cop kills somebody, then that cop needs to go on trial, period. If that cop happens to be acquitted later based upon the physical evidence, that's fine. But a trial needs to happen.
Well, and I would add some just simple technologies which are now available.
Yes.
If you had a system, which you can easily build, where every time an officer pulled his weapon, an orange light goes off on a board which is being observed by others at the police headquarters or other site, and immediately that means that support cars are sent to that site where the gun has been pulled. If you then had that light go to red, if the weapon is actually fired, you would immediately create a situation where there's an opportunity for more thought in the pulling of a weapon, in the drawing of a weapon. But the question of the use of force is a very complex one. In Portland, years ago, we had a case of a chokehold death of an ex-Marine that really never was adequately resolved. That was during the period of time when police were in revenge because I think they were too bored at night catching possums and throwing them at places where black people congregated. That was really disgusting, but it also reflected a culture of cynicism and a culture of racism. It's not easy to find people to serve as police officers and to be fully aware. I have known some police officers who were extremely aware and very careful and very concerned, but they often lost the trust of their colleagues and felt a little threatened because they weren't sure how backup would work. And I know this. This is not, you know, some projection on my part. This is after talking to a lot of police. And I also know, and what I mentioned earlier, the question of how police are educated, that there is an isolation that takes place to create a community of law enforcement, which has its own subcultures, its own rules, its own understandings about the civilian population generally, and persons of color in particular. All of that needs to be broken down. All of that needs to be changed. And that's very hard to do, but if you don't start, you never will get anywhere near that. And mm-hmm. and in fact, Portland has been very resistant in these areas. In fact, as people probably know, the city is under Justice Department requirements now to start dealing with the way in which police handle people who are disturbed. Mm-hmm. And they've been very resistant to actually doing anything that really matters in that context. The police, as a community, have a job which is frequently very boring and tedious, and they are not seeing the best of humanity ever. And then, occasionally, there are moments of absolute decision-making terror, which involves the drawing of a weapon or the use of physical force at an extreme level. This all contributes to a culture which has notoriously had problems in its own domestic life, in its own interactions, and in a sense of isolation. It's an us or them situation. And when you structure that into the police situation by segregating the police and their training from the rest of society, you're creating immediately a set of problems that are going to continue on and on and on. But overarching for me of all of this is the active awareness that whether police persons realize it or not, they are essentially the front line of a class structure. And it is their job historically, and still the case, to, in restoring order, to support a system of repression and of capitalism. And that's just real. That's just there.
Okay, I want to touch back on this before the end on what you and I would do to fix everything if we could.
Yeah, I think the guy raised some good questions.
Indeed. Let's go back to the phones in the meantime. Dave, good morning.
Yeah, that's a good thing to talk about what we can do. I've got two things I want to talk about. One is when when I was young, I'm not young anymore.
Okay.
But when I was young, until I was about 30, I was routinely hassled by cops all the time, driving, walking. Not as much as black people that I saw around me. I'm not black at all.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I was getting hassled by them a lot. And then suddenly, I got pulled over one time when I was about 30 or 32, and the cop treated me like a brother. And from then on, now everything's cool. They protect and serve me. If I was black, that wouldn't be the case.
You just had to put in your time.
Are you saying as you get older, you suddenly pass beyond the age of people that need to be hassled?
Right. And I turned 30 in 1970.
Mm-hmm. Ah,
so that was a time when there was a lot of youth rebellion going on. So to be fair, but there was still a lot of rebellion going on when they started treating me like a brother. So I think there's a thing about youth, and I kind of think it works like this is, like somebody said earlier that the object is to make sure that white people are at least we're thankful that we're not black. They give you some treatment as if you were black when you're young, and then they lighten up. And
is that a kind of a pun there?
Yeah.
I didn't mean
it that way, but I guess it
I don't want to quibble over semantics, but I really doubt that you got a sampling of what it is like to be a person of color at the hands of the
police. No, not at
all.
But it was something. I said it. Black
people. No, I think it's interesting what you're talking
about. Around me were treated a lot worse.
But
I got slammed around a bit. The other thing is I went to a grand jury. I was on a grand jury for a month,
mm-hmm.
and. So I have some little insight onto that culture. And what happens there is they don't question you or anything. If anybody that's got a warm body and is willing to be there for a month can do it.
Mm-hmm.
So So the grand jury was made up mainly of people with jobs like postal, library, intel, and retired people. And so it starts out, and a DA comes in and explains that basically what you guys are doing is you're a focus group for the DA. We're going to bring cases to you, and if you think it's a viable case, if there's, you know, we're only going to tell you our side of the story. You're not going to hear the defense, but we want to see if a regular group of people think that this is a viable case.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they do, and they bring in case after case after case. You hear probably 10 cases a day. 8 or 10 cases a day, and a lot of them are really horrible. And the same DAs come in. There's, I don't know, a dozen different ones that, mm-hmm. that bring the cases in. You only hear their side of the story. You only hear you talk to witnesses, but you know they're witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, it becomes the same cops come in too. A lot of the same cops, not as you know, more a bigger group, but you still see a bunch of the same ones.
Mm-hmm.
So our friends are the DAs and the cops. They're the ones that we kind of relate to and we look mm-hmm. up to. They tell us what's what. To the point where, and the group on the grand jury are nice people. They're, you know, normal, ordinary, decent people. But we had a kind of a contest about who's our favorite DA and who's our favorite cop. So we didn't have, there was no police shootings or anything. They weren't prosecuting any cops. But had they been prosecuting any cops, there is no way that group of people would have voted to send a cop to trial.
Hmm. So
was the whole purpose of the grand jury.
A flawed system then.
Huh?
A flawed system that can't be objective about police misconduct.
Yeah, it can't be. It's just not. I can't imagine. At least the group I was on, we were the major crimes. There's several grand juries for major crimes and drugs and domestic.
Listen, I hate to be rude, but can you bring it to a point here? We need to give some other folks a chance.
Well, I think the point of having a special prosecutor whenever a cop shoots somebody is that's. You know, got to get it out of the county grand jury. That's not going to happen.
Yeah, I would
happen.
Agree.
Yeah, and hassling, you know, really hammering at the police force to change the culture, which is difficult but very disruptive. But crime's going down. We don't need armed cops unless you're worried about the population revolting and rising up against capitalism.
Well, according to his commentators on Fox News, Michael Brown should have been considered armed simply because he was large and black.
Yeah, right.
So,
yeah.
So I guess that in that case, he would have been entitled to Second Amendment protections as a living gun, right?
There you go.
All right. Well, hey, thank you for the call.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
All right.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 and Alternative Radio, Professor Michael Schwartz speaks on oil and gas wars. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints features an encore broadcast of interviews from the annual Indigenous Peoples Sunrise Ceremony on Alcatraz Island on Thanksgiving morning. At 11, on stage and studio, host Sarika Mehta speaks with actor and writer Asif Manvi, senior Muslim correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. His recently published memoir is No Man's Land.
He's a very funny guy.
He is a very funny guy. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan interviews Julia Dolan, the curator of photography at the Portland Art Museum, about the show Blue Sky, the Oregon Center for the Photographic Arts at 40. All this and more coming up today on KBOO. What else, Joe? Would we do, you and I, if we could fix everything? I can tell you one more thing.
Go ahead. Tell me your thing.
I would revise history curricula in American public schools so as to educate white people about the complete experience of being a person of color in this country. Not the glossed over kumbaya, happy civil rights era stories most of us get. I think that white America needs to stare this phenomenon square in the face.
Well, I agree with you on that one. I think that that the whole way in which we as a society, and this probably is true of every culture, deal with our own histories is always to favor the established order and the established facts of history as they are presented at the present time. So it's never really a critical view. There are better history books, the People's History of the United States, for example, yep. that could do a better job. Those books do not, in general, make it into the general classroom situation.
Agreed. I want to read a little something right now.
Okay.
If you want to be an anti-racist, if you want to be an ally, I suggest a good place to start is the writings of Tim Wise, a really smart guy. I'm going to read from a recent column of his on Salon.com. The history of law enforcement in America with regard to black folks has been one of unremitting oppression. That is neither hyperbole nor opinion, but incontrovertible fact. From slave patrols to overseers to the black codes to lynching, it is a fact. From dozens of white-on-black riots that marked the first half of the 20th century, in which cops participated actively, to Watts, to Rodney King, to Abner Louima, to Amadou Diallo, to the railroading of the Central Park Five, it is a fact. From the New Orleans Police Department's killings of Adolph Archie to Henry Glover, to the Danziger Bridge shootings there in the wake of Katrina, to stop and frisk in places like New York, it's a fact. And the fact that white people don't know this history, have never been required to learn it, and be considered even remotely informed citizens without knowing it, explains a lot about what's wrong with America. Black people have to learn everything about white people just to stay alive. They especially, and quite obviously, have to know what scares us, what triggers the reptilian part of our brains, and convinces us that they intend to do us harm. Meanwhile, we, white people, need to know nothing whatsoever about them. We don't have to know their history, their experiences, their hopes and dreams, or their fears. And we can go right on being oblivious to all that without consequence. It won't be on the test, so to speak.
You know, that's funny that you should mention that. I was invited to talk to a group of honor students out of the community college system. Oh, this was years ago. And the teacher, the professor who was kind of chairing the event, and I took a walk afterward. The event took place near the convention center in one of the hotels there. And we were walking around the neighborhood. And he expressed, you know, he was being very honest. He was nervous. This was the East Side. This was the Near East Side. There are many, many people, by the way, on the West Side who say they don't even want to go near the East Side because of the danger, by which they mean persons of color, the dangers of the East Side. And as we're walking along, and he's expressing concern, I'm saying, oh, you know, everything's fine. It's cool. And I'm walking along. Suddenly this black man comes toward us, and he comes toward us, and he's big and he's black. And my colleague becomes visibly alarmed. And the guy comes up to us and says, hey, hi, Joe. And I said, hi. And of course he was the producer of a local television show that I was involved with. And it was so funny, but not funny, that kind of knee-jerk, almost visceral fear of the other
yeah.
that dominates in a segregated society, which this is, even in Portland, Oregon, that dominates the thinking of people. African-American male, danger, 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 you know.
Yeah.
And again, the notion, which I have heard a lot, that the East Side is more problematic than the West Side for middle class or wealthy whites. So we really, you know, we want to deny all these things, but we really need to understand that they are built-in dangers, and they're not just biases. They are in fact things that impact upon the lives of the less powerful, of whom black people and persons of color, all persons of color, share a really negative stereotype.
Let's go back to the phones.
Okay,
who's next? Francis, good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
It's interesting to hear white people discuss racism in this country. And I agree with Chris Rock. The problem is not with black people. It's with the perceptions of white people and their base fear, which is truly, to me, very base, fear of black men.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to recommend a book. It's called From Superman to Man by J.A. Rogers. It's out of print, so you have to like get Powell to find one for you. But in it is a very lengthy discussion between a black porter and a racist Southern senator on a train ride. A reporter who speaks 7 languages and is very educated. The only job he can get, of course, is a job on the train. Mm-hmm. But their conversation is quite enlightening, and it reveals a lot of the base fear that white men have. First, before I say anything else, I would like to acknowledge Keaton Otis, a family friend. May 12, 2010, he was executed by the Portland Police Department on Northeast 6th and Halsey. And every 12th of every month, there's a vigil for him. There will be one this Friday or Saturday at 6 p.m. on Northeast 6th and Halsey. When you speak of racial profiling, my sons, who are mixed race, have been profiled while driving, but predominantly while walking in their own neighborhood. My youngest son was profiled probably 15 times within a 3-year span when he first started looking like a young man as a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
I believe this is a system-wide problem. It's ingrained in the system. The prison industrial complex is making a lot of money off of our children. The DAs, I find to be most culpable. When they had that public inquest, so-called,
mm-hmm.
when Michael Schrunk interviewed people regarding the execution of James Perez within 24 seconds of stopping him, mm-hmm. he was killed. And the leading questions that the DA asked the witnesses, the policemen, was appalling, and that he was allowed to do that was appalling.
Mm-hmm.
And the vilification of the victim was more appalling. They spent more time in that inquest discussing how much cocaine was in James Perez's system than what actually happened. I fault the DAs all over this country for not prosecuting when young people are killed or anybody is killed by the police department, when it's obvious that they have some very serious issues and fear problems. I can put it down to their fear. And I think it's a base man thing, and I'm going to say it.
I think you're exactly correct.
I think that we as people need to address that before any kind of reconciliation or anything can be done. We talk about truth and reconciliation. The truth has to be told, and has to be told directly and honestly.
Well, there's another. I want to introduce another aspect to this, which is very important about police behavior. Officers are taught and learn very quickly that they must take control of any given situation. Now,
right.
What that ends up meaning in practical terms is that they will use any amount of force to feel that they have gained control, and they're quick to use force. They are not involved in a process of de-escalation.
And that's part of the way they're trained, and it's also the policies and procedures of a city. As I understand it, in Ferguson, there's this, or in New York, there's this broken window concept where you just harass people who are doing maybe petty things. And in Portland, we had the unconstitutional drug-free zones, which targeted mm-hmm. the whole community and allowed the police to just, you know, come up on people and find out what they're doing. Keaton, though, was driving his mama's car, and Rosie Sizer had just been fired that day, mm-hmm. and these officers in the hot spot, whatever they were, troop, I call them, that were roaming the city looking for possible gang activity, profiled Keaton and followed him, boxed him in, and then killed him, period.
Mm-hmm.
And they were mad because Rosie was being fired.
Well,
you know, they're so wrong in what they do, but they're allowed to do it by the cities, the municipalities, and the district attorney.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned...
They say the district attorney can indict a ham sandwich if he wanted to. Well, he sure as hell, he pretends to be in trying to indict somebody. What he's doing is defending the police. That police, that DA in Ferguson was defending the officer.
Mm-hmm.
In the grand jury. And also, there's only supposed to be, I think you only have need 9 votes to indict. So
yes.
You have to
well,
have
it varies
votes.
From state
nine
to state, but yeah.
Right. There it was 9 out of 12. So there could have been 8 people who who thought the man should be indicted, but that wasn't enough. So to say that the grand jury said he was not guilty is a false statement. Grand jury didn't try that man.
Yeah, and you
to bring him to trial.
You remind me of another case, which is the Kendra James case, where a young woman panicked and tried to get away driving an automobile and was shot dead. This is a classic
Kendra
example.
Kendra James.
Yep. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. This is a classic.
In Portland.
Yeah.
Right, if you want numbers, we can count 20 people in Portland within the last 20 years. You know, we don't need any more numbers.
Yeah,
need
you're
right.
Right.
Well, I wanted to tell the truth.
Yeah, let me talk just for a moment about what happened in that case, because I think it's absolutely typical of what goes on. First of all, the overreaction of the police. If in a reasonable world, she had been stopped later by officers in cars. If in fact,
I'll tell you what I think after. Okay.
Okay. If in fact it had been a reasonable exchange, she would be alive today. So there was an inquest, a public inquest held, and this is a tactic of the police in Portland and I think elsewhere, at a church, at a black church, thereby theoretically preventing people from getting angry and using foul language. But the strategy is to create a calm environment. The inquest was totally nonsense. I've got to change my language here. Totally nonsense. And in the end, there was no real investigation of what other options were available and why the case went down the way it went. And I found that, and I was there, I found that to be an extremely typical case of the whitewashing of the police. Now, what did you want to say? Because I want to give you a chance.
Kendra James.
Yeah.
Kendra James was supposedly stopped because she had a street warrant, quote unquote, for attempting to possess cocaine. She was not aware of it. The policeman knew who she was. They followed her. They knew who she was. They followed her car. They stopped the car for a California stop. They found a pretext stop to stop them.
Yeah.
When they had the people get out of the car. When they told Kendra she had a warrant, she said, no, I do not. And she tried to leave. The officer shot her because she was trying to leave.
Yeah, that's
not
true. He
was afraid for his life or anything.
Francis, I have to cut
and
you off.
I believe that they had a history with Kendra, and they have a history of when people are drug addicted, in order to get out of jail, you have to sign an agreement. People don't realize this. To help them convict or arrest so many more people.
I have to cut you off because we're out of time. I do appreciate your comments, and I'm glad you reminded us of some of the issues around Kendra James. I want to tell people to stay tuned, listen to KBOO. We'll probably be dealing with these topics more than once.
I'm sure. Thanks to everybody who called in today.
I really do want to hear from law enforcement people as well. So, next time we do it, hey, if you're a law enforcement person, give us a call.
All right. We'll be back at you next week.
Silence on the dock of the bay, from the brave, the bold, the battered heart of Chevrolet. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Do you worry that corporate power is totally out of control? Tune into the KBOO Evening News every Tuesday evening at 5 p.m. beginning August 5th to hear the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. I'll be sharing stories about communities that are rising up against corporate control and passing laws that exercise their right to govern themselves. That's every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News beginning August 5th. Don't miss it.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on Alternative Radio, Professor Michael Schwartz speaks on oil and gas wars. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints features an encore broadcast of interviews from the annual Indigenous Peoples Sunrise Ceremony on Alcatraz Island on Thanksgiving morning. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host Sarika Mehta speaks with actor and writer Asif Manvi, senior Muslim correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. His recently published memoir is No Man's Land. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Galivan interviews